Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Why Would You Tell Me That? I'm the host, Neil Delamere. I'm joined by another host. That's how this thing works. Dave Moore. How are you, Dave?
Good. Two hosts is what we have.
Two hosts. And if you haven't caught the show so far, basically one of us tells the other one some very interesting facts, something interesting about the world, and then gets a genuine expert to back up our nonsense in part two.
Yeah, and the thing is as well, you see, that the other person is as in the dark as you are right now, listening.
Absolutely.
Because I know what's coming up. Neil does not know what's coming up. If you listen to the last episode, you'll know I use the words volcano and Frankenstein. And that's all you need to know. This is the big one. This, to me, is the perfect Why Would You Tell Me That episode.
You went so far off air as if to suggest that this is the reason that we do this show in this format. You were so excited to tell me about this particular one. Before you do, I have to say a couple of things. If you want us to cover something, get in touch on Instagram. We are at Why Would You Tell Me That. We're also on Twitter as well. And Dave, you're at on Instagram.
At Dave Today FM is where you'll find me.
I'm at Neil Delamere Comedy. You can get in touch with us on various platforms. We are also proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. Now, consider my appetite whetted, Dave. What have you got for me?
We're going to talk about the eruption of Mount Tambora.
That sounds like a stripper's name. I'll be perfectly honest with you. I don't know anything about the eruption of Mount Tambora.
Okay, well, here's the thing. This eruption, obviously, eruption would lead you to probably understand it's a volcano, but this eruption will lead us to talk about things like why there was a famine in Ireland, why the opium epidemic happened in China, why we got what's called the year with no summer, and why we got Frankenstein. It's all because of Tambora.
Of one thing.
Yeah. Look, this is honestly one of the most interesting things I've ever heard in my life. So I'm very excited that I'm not going to be telling you about it.
But I think we're all very excited that you're not going to be telling us about it. All right.
One of the most qualified humans I think we've ever had on the podcast and may ever have on the podcast is somebody called Gillan Darcy Wood, who is the Professor of Environmental Humanities in the University of Illinois, an Associate Director of the Institute for Sustainability, Energy and the Environment, and the Director of the Undergraduate Certificate in Environmental Writing, as well as the author of a definitive book on Mount Tambora. So, oh my God, is the guy we have in part two the most qualified person around?
Okay, you've brought the A game. I look forward to this. I mean, he's going to cover a lot of ground there.
He is.
That's very impressive.
This could be a long one, but we'll see how we go. But yeah, look. Honestly, I think it is genuinely one of the most interesting natural events that I've ever heard of because it's within a couple of hundred years of now. You know, it's not as though it's something that I'm telling you. For example, about Vesuvius, 79 AD. We'll talk about that in a second. Like, that just seems so far away. And then the ones before that are, you know, hundreds of thousands and millions of years ago. But this is relatively recent. We've got records. We've got newspapers. There's so many ways to actually understand how this affected us as humans. And it is fascinating. But I think in order to understand this conversation, we need to understand a couple of points. And number one on this, I think, is something called the VEI, which is the Volcanic Explosivity Index.
Right. It's how annoyed Alex Ferguson gets depending on how well you played in the first half.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's, you know what? It's like the Richter scale. I don't know if you know how the Richter scale works, but a 4 on the Richter scale, like a 5 isn't one more. It's multiples more, right?
I do know one thing. We don't use the Richter scale anymore because I did a documentary about earthquakes. We use the MMS, I think, and one is a magnitude of the other, isn't it? It's 10 times it.
Exactly. And that,
so it's a similar thing, is it?
Yeah, I think that's why they changed from the Richter scale. So the Richter scale was 31 times as many, which, let's face it, is a little bit imperial and not very metric. So they moved to the metric version. So yeah, so the VEI is done exactly like that. So if I tell you about a volcanic eruption that was a 4, well, then a 5 is 10 times as much as that. So it's very important to remember that when we're talking about this, because these numbers will be quite, you know, they'll seem quite, you know, small. Oh, God, if it was a 6, but like a 6 is 10 times bigger than a 5. So that's important. And to put things in perspective, probably the most famous volcano eruption of all time, I think anyway, is Vesuvius. If I asked, you know, people on the spot to name a volcanic eruption.
Yeah, they go Pompeii, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And can
and
I
then
just
go Vesuvius.
Yeah, and Pompeii, to be fair, whoever the PR guy was for ancient Pompeii, he deserves whatever raise he ever gets, because there was another city completely blanketed in ash and destroyed called Stabiae. Have you ever heard of that?
I have never heard of Stabiae. No, I've heard of Herculeum and Pompeii. I've been there, but no, where's Stabium? Yeah.
So Stabiae was a city like near Pompeii that was suffered pretty much the same fate, but yet all we hear about is Pompeii and Vesuvius. So that Vesuvius eruption, again, as I said, probably the most famous of all eruptions to most normal humans like ourselves, that was a 5, okay?
Right.
So that's a big, big eruption. As we know, I mean, obviously, we're dealing with, you know, archaeological finds to try and determine how many people may have perished in that kind of eruption. But it's thought that it's at least 1,000 people. Obviously, you know, I don't know how populated those two cities were, Pompeii and Stabiae, but about 1,000 people is what kind of archaeologists hazard a guess. It's around that number. Another one, which again, I think people know the name, but maybe don't know much about it, but Krakatoa.
Yeah, that's just after that they invented the lava lamp, yeah.
1883.
That's not true.
No. Sometimes it's hard to know because Neil is an authority on a lot of things. But that definitely isn't the case. That was, by the way, in 1883. This is so mind-blowing, right? 13,000 times more powerful than the atomic bomb.
That's 13,000 times more than Hiroshima and Nagasaki, than those bombs. No way.
Yeah, when it erupted in Indonesia, and the explosion was heard in East Africa.
What did they think it was?
Exactly.
It's those kids throwing those bangers again.
They're illegal. Where do they even get them? They've been to Newry.
they're buying fireworks. It's September, for Christ's sake. Every year it gets earlier and earlier. You don't think it could be a volcano in Indonesia? That's utterly ridiculous. We're in East Africa at this point. It's far more likely to be some sort of incendiary Catherine wheel or a Roman candle. Wow.
It would be ludicrous to think that, but that is the force of a 6. And that is what Krakatoa was. It was a 6.
So Vesuvius was 5, Krakatoa 6.
When we get on to Tambora is most definitely a 7. And some people say, and I'll be interested to find out what Gillen thinks, some people say it might even have been an 8. So, in my terrible maths, I'm just going to throw it out there. If a 6 is 13,000 times more powerful than the atomic bomb was, then a 7 should theoretically be 130,000 times more powerful, because it's 10 times more, like, who knows? But we'll ask the expert on that. But that, look, if an 8 happened anywhere, we're all gonzo.
In anywhere on planet Earth,
pretty much. An 8 is like, forget.
And can we say, when you say this, some people think it's a 7, well, it's guaranteed a 7, but some people think it's an 8. And that is based on scientific measurements. It's not the same as a nightclub. There's no volcano. There's no volcano goggles, are there? There's no.
Oh, I thought it was a 7, but then after 6 Carlsbergs, she really looked like an 8.
No, surely it would be Sambuca, because that's what you'd set on fire. Surely that's what
it would be.
Of
course, it would be.
Oh my God! So this is a 7. I can't believe I've never heard of this.
I know,
it was such an impactful event in human history.
Nor could I, to be honest. I suppose the most recent one that we all remember was the Icelandic volcano, which we all like to call the Icelandic volcano, because pretty much nobody can say Heyja Fjalla Jökull, which, of course, I can say because I am a linguistic nerd.
What is it? Do you give it to me again?
Heya Fjalla Jökull.
Okay, can you do it as Björk?
Heya Fjalla Jökull. I need to send an immediate tweet of apology to Björk. Björk, I'm so sorry. That was terrible. I don't know what you sound like, but you don't sound like that.
I thought you were well within your rights to just refuse that. But you are really a linguistic nerd because you went, I can do this. Part of your brain went, I can do this. I'm going to nail this. And also, he's not going to know anyway. So
that's true. But interestingly, that volcano, while it obviously downed air travel around most of Europe, in fact, around a lot of parts of the world, it resulted in zero debt. You know, thankfully, it was 2010. It was remote enough. It certainly wasn't a 5 or a 6 or a 7. By comparison, Krakatoa, which we talked about there as a 6, 36,000 people died. And that's without knowing what else happened as a kind of a fallout. So 36,000, dead very quickly. So an eruption like that can be pretty devastating. But, Heia Fiat Lakatl wasn't quite that. So, and interestingly as well, I didn't know this. Undersea volcanoes account for 75% of volcanic activity on Earth.
You're beginning to freak me out now. I mean, there's stuff going on that I don't even know about. Like, presumably this is just bubbling away all the time.
Yeah.
And maybe you know. I'd like to ask our expert. Are we any better at knowing if and when these events are going to happen?
Well, there is a story around Mount Tambora, which again, I'll let Gillen tell you, but there are stories of the earth making noises and puffs of smoke and things that we now know are kind of pre-dinner.
Seismic.
Yeah, pre-dinner belches before the explosion happened. But I suppose, back in the 1800s and before that, that wasn't widely known. And people just thought, oh, it's some weird thing with the land. Sure, what are we worried about? We've lived here all our lives kind of thing. But then obviously, unfortunately, things happened that then resulted in lots and lots of deaths. The undersea stuff is fascinating. I know I've seen on some of those nature programs before, and there are vents in the very deep trenches of the ocean where, it would be almost impossible for anything to live. But things can live there because of the heat and the sulfur that's being emitted by these vents, these tubes coming out of the earth at that really deep level. There are microscopic things and these very strange fish things that can live off the sulfur. And because of the heat, they can exist down there. It's crazy.
I've seen a geyser. Mm. I've seen a geyser. I have been to Iceland and I've seen a geyser erupt. And I used to say that nothing makes you feel more inadequate as a man than watching a geyser erupt. And then your girlfriend at the time going, Anna can do it again in 10 minutes as well.
I don't think you should be comparing yourself to geological phenomena, if I'm honest. It's bad enough standing beside someone in a urinal. You're comparing yourself to the power of a massive planet.
What, you mean you don't call yours Old Faithful as well, do you not?
Another quick thing I learned as I was kind of doing a bit of research on this is the volcanoes in space.
Just volcanoes in space is the name of some sort of movie franchise that we haven't seen yet, but we should watch.
You definitely
volcanoes
should.
In space, pigs in space, volcanoes in space. These are going to be massive. These are going to be the size of planets or something.
Yeah, they're terrifying stuff. Well, like for example, the biggest one in our solar system. And don't forget, we've explored very little of space, even with the probes and telescopes. We know very little. But what we do know is, a fair bit about our solar system. People have probably heard of Olympus Mons, which is a very famous volcano. It's on Mars. It is the biggest volcano in our solar system. But what I love about this is its dimensions, right? So look, it's very tall. It's 26 kilometers tall, which is 3 times the height of Mount Everest.
Okay, that's right? Pretty tall.
That is tall. However, that's nothing compared to how wide Olympus Mons is. It's France. It's France.
It's 26 kilometers tall.
Tall.
And it's France wide,
which is 600 kilometers, but it's France wide and it's one volcano.
It's like a volcanic Danny DeVito. In his early days, it's wider than it's tall.
The analogy I didn't know I needed, but that is exactly it. 600 kilometers wide, 20 something times wider than it is tall. And here's the thing, right? That's one, Olympus Mons is one of 4 volcanoes that all sit together. Like there's 3 other giant ones, not as big as Olympus Mons, but they're so big and so heavy that they actually shifted the surface of Mars about 3 billion years ago. It moved that whole tectonic plate 20 degrees from the poles down towards the equator. Just those volcanoes.
It's like when you see a guy with old school kind of brain surgery and the stitches in a film. The plate, literally, fracture plate has slid down his head because it's so heavy.
It's gone from the top of his head down towards his ear by 20 degrees.
I think Matt Damon needs to go back. I mean, saw very well him sciencing the shit out of the planet to get off. It was a very good film and all the rest. But I mean, there's clearly bits that he needs to talk about a bit more.
He needs to go and explore more. And then there are cryo volcanoes, which just sound like, if you want to make the volcanoes in space movie, then movie two is volcanoes in space, cryo volcanoes.
I'm going to guess a cryo is freezing.
You got it. So on Saturn,
cryotherapy.
Yeah, on Saturn's moon Enceladus, there are volcanoes on the surface that we can see. Now, Enceladus is small. It's a small moon, right?
When Enceladus, you buy them from a truck and a Mexican man.
Can I have a chicken Enceladus, please? No.
Yeah.
It's a very small moon, but visible when you look through a telescope are these raised white, because it's absolutely freezing, frozen mountains, and they spray out jets of water vapor, ice, a mix of who knows what gases out into space from the surface of this moon. It's a volcano, but it's freezing.
It's so that's the Saturn moon. That's the one that's not the Quesadillas is the other moon, isn't it? And Burrito is the other moon. So but this thing is like Bellagio fountain. It's not firing out magma. It's firing out water.
Yeah, absolutely. Water vapor, ice, like. You know, obviously the whole entire thing would be an uninhabitable giant nightmare. But if you were there, that's what you would see. If you were there as a volcano tourist and you had your Nikon or your Canon camera and you stood on the surface of Enceladus with a burrito in one hand and a camera in the other, you would see volcanoes of white ice.
I bet Elton John's had that at a party. I bet that has been the centerpiece during his full-on tiaras and tantrums. Rocket Man stuff. I bet he's had that. There's been an ice sculpture of a swan, and then there's been
an ice volcano beside it.
And there's been a full ice volcano. He demanded it.
Yeah, and then for some inexplicable reason, a Mexican food cart right beside that. But nobody understands except Elton.
And a mariachi band. Try my ice sculpture.
But here's the thing, right? And I want to ask Ilan about this in part two. I sometimes get this feeling of, I don't know, I really enjoy it, but it's a feeling of absolute and utter irrelevance as a race. Like the belief that, you know, we are somehow, you know, important as humans and, you know, like we've managed to understand our world and we can explore the galaxy or the solar system. So we're somehow, no. Volcano, eight, boom, gone, dead. Planet survives, planet regenerates, you know, 100,000 years later, there's green, there's trees, there's, because we live in this kind of Goldilocks thing. So I just love these kind of, like, I absolutely firmly believe in the human effect on climate change, but I also believe that the Earth goes through periods of cooling and heating up, and we are irrelevant in the grand scheme of things. We've been here for 50,000, 100,000, whatever you want to say. The Earth's been 13 billion years old. Well, the universe is, you know what I mean? Like, I love this feeling of nihilism.
Well, I can tell you you're irrelevant if you want. I mean, I'm more than happy to say it, that you're completely unimportant and trivial in the grand scheme of things. And your entire existence is pointless and it's a complete freak of a few small or actually probably massive coincidences. And actually, like the opposite of It's a Wonderful Life. If you were gone, nobody would miss you. How's
you know what I feel? This is all I ever want from someone. Thank you, Neil.
This is why I don't write greeting cards. You very specific reason.
You are irrelevant. Time is a construct. Good day to you, sir. Happy birthday, Dad.
I'm going to leave all of my meetings saying that from now on. You are irrelevant. Time is a construct. Are we even here? Good day to you, sir. And then I'm going to buy a top hat and have a monocle and just doff it.
Well, so, sorry. The reason I was bringing this up was Yellowstone, famously.
Yeah.
We talked about geysers. Yellowstone is an active volcano in this area in the US. And obviously, were it to erupt,
picnic baskets would be destroyed.
Picnic baskets. No, honestly, it would be so incredibly detrimental to the existence of not only the people in North America, but the entire planet, because it is such a massive, it has the potential to be an 8, Yellowstone. So NASA came up with a plan to cool Yellowstone, because it's the heating up of Yellowstone that will eventually cause it to erupt. That is the nature of a volcano. And they came up with this plan to say, you know what we can do? We can cool Yellowstone and preserve humanity for another 100,000 years, whatever it is. So their idea was, we drill massive holes down into the earth and we fill them with freezing cold water. Well, not freezing cold water, but just above freezing cold water. And America went, do you know what? That's probably a pretty good idea because it would keep the temperature. Yeah. How much would this cost? $3.5 billion. Do you know what? We'll just take our chances and we'll head off and build some roads or do whatever it is we do with the $3.5 billion. Now, I know for an economy like America, $3.5 billion isn't a lot, but they just decided not to cool Yellowstone and do other stuff. And maybe we'll all not thank them for that in the future when they decided to move away from NASA's plan.
It's quite difficult given the short-termism of politics that you can go, here, can we spend $3.5 billion for something that might not happen? And if it does happen, you'll all be long dead and et cetera, et cetera.
Someone goes, yeah, but what about the freeway? And they go, yeah, let's build a freeway.
Yeah. Like, it is remarkable. It's a remarkable testament to what Joe Biden is trying to do now in terms of the environment. And David Attenborough, Sir David Attenborough. Like with the best will in the world, David Attenborough's 94, 95, right? He's going to be finished on the earth
in the
not too distant future. Yeah, and he wants to leave it in good stead for everybody else coming after him instead of tearing the arse out of it like the rest of us would. So, one, it makes me look at him and think that's amazing. But two, it makes me think he has never driven a hire car. There is a man who has never just gone, I'm not gonna need this myself in a while.
Or if he did, he returned it after he cleaned it.
Yeah. I just upgraded that, actually. I just put some more expensive diesel into it and did the scoreboard.
Neil's understanding of cars is to upgrade a car. I put more expensive diesel in. Is that cool?
I was going to build up to it. I was going to say, and I changed the furry dice. I've put fuel injectors on the wing ones.
I've stuck Dave and guest stickers over the windscreen.
Dave and expert. Anyone who wants it. And all I know about this general area is the father of seismology and the man who coined the term seismology was an Irishman called Robert Mallet. Okay. And he blew up, I'm trying to remember, it was a Dalkey or Killiney beach. He buried gunpowder and he blew it up to see the waves.
Oh, could he get a flicker on a scale?
Yeah, because I got to explore the quarry once. In a documentary. And do you know his family used to own an iron foundry and the railings around Trinity College were made by his family, the Mallets.
I did not know that.
There you go now. I mean, it's not, he's the size of France or anything like that, but it's not my episode.
but it's certainly worth knowing. It's not your episode. Are you feeling, why would you tell me that? Is it starting to bubble up inside you like an erupting volcano?
I am 100% feeling what... I mean, even before this guest, who has more letters after their name than any normal human needs, who is going to be good, and the event that is of such, I was going to say seismic proportions, but it is seismic proportions and geopolitical proportions by the sounds of things. Even before this person, all that nonsense you've just told me, and I use nonsense in the best possible sense,
yes, thank you.
I am fully on board. The information, unlike you in your existence, is highly relevant.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear it.
Bring on part 2.
Okay, well, let's do part 2 with Gillon Darcy Wood, Professor of Environmental Humanities in the University of Illinois. He'll join us in a few minutes.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
So, Neil, it's part two, and we are joined now by somebody who has one of the most qualified set of titles I've ever read out. Please welcome Gillan Darcy Wood, Professor of Environmental Humanities at the University of Illinois, Associate Director of the Institute for Sustainability, Energy and the Environment, and the Director of the Undergraduate Certificate in Environmental Writing. Gillan, hello.
Thanks so much, Dave. Good to be with you.
That's all we have time for. Thank you very much. Join us on the next episode of I Would Still Be There.
So, Gillan, I've teased Neil and our audience a little bit about Mount Tambora and the massive implications that Mount Tambora had on everything in the world, effectively, certainly everything in our part of the world here in Western Europe, and of course, where it actually erupted. But can you give us, I suppose, a little idea about what happened around the time of the eruption, when it was, when in history it was, and what happened?
The eruption occurred in 1815, which, if you sort of scour your memory banks in a high school history class and think 1815, well, that has to be the Battle of Waterloo and the end of the Napoleonic Wars. And the battle actually occurred about 6 weeks after the volcano erupted in Indonesia, or as it was then, the Dutch East Indies, in 1815. And the question I often get is, oh, did the weather impacts from the eruption affect the outcome of the Battle of Waterloo? Because I'm not sure how detailed your recollection of the battle is, but Napoleon was on the brink of victory until he was stymied by bad weather, which allowed time for the Prussian mercenaries to sweep in.
Of course, yeah.
But actually, the answer is not to deflate your expectations. But no, there was no relationship. There is no relationship whatsoever between the weather at Waterloo and the eruption of Mount Tambora, though Tambora did have a cataclysmic impact on global weather in the years following. That's too short a time frame.
Okay.
For the volcanic aerosols to impact weather systems over Europe. So there's an historical coordinate for you, the Battle of Waterloo and Mount Tambora. And one of the reasons I wrote the book was to, in a way, rewrite history because, yes, we all think of 1815 and Napoleon and the post-Napoleonic period and the great economic downturn that faced Europe and Britain and Ireland after the war, which has always been attributed to the massive demobilization of Europe's armies. And so, you know, so many more mouths to feed and men flooding back to their towns and villages with no work. And that was certainly sort of part of the great problem. But what historians have missed because of their environmental and meteorological blind spot, what they've missed is the fact that the weather was the worst in a millennium. So you had these terrible floods and cold summer weather from Ireland all the way across through middle part of Europe, and that's really what set the stage for the humanitarian disaster.
Where exactly is Tambora?
All right, so perhaps some of your listeners have heard of Bali. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Well, I'm originally from Australia, And Bali is a chosen locale for Australians to make fools of themselves in Southeast Asia. I mean, I suppose where don't they? But Bali is there about 6 degrees south of the equator in Indonesia. It's a picturesque Pacific island. And so if you think it just a, you know, 50 miles, 60 miles east of Bali, an island called Sumbawa, that is the location of the volcano.
Okay.
So think shots of tequila and henna tattoos. And roughly that's where we're talking about.
That's where we're talking. It's, I was en route to Sumbawa and was in Bali, and the Balinese have never been to Sumbawa.
Okay.
So it's like two different worlds. So Bali is, you know, obviously overrun by Australians, Western tourists, and, you know, and to the east there. Sumbawa is an island really kind of lost in time, very relative to Bali, extremely underdeveloped, very few foreign visitors whatsoever.
And have you ever gone there?
So it takes quite a bit of imagination and persistence to actually get to Sumbawa.
Okay.
And travel about. The roads to the volcano are awful. I spent the entire time sort of holding on. I was cramped in this SUV, and we broke down three or four times, barely made it.
Wow.
In a sense, I wish we hadn't, because it took 2 days to climb up the bloody volcano, and I was in no fit state to do that, and picking leeches off my legs the whole time.
I don't know why it's not popular with tourists at all. I can't understand it.
I don't think it's going to be any more popular after Gillen has sold it to us like this.
Well, if you know, the view is like nothing else. It's like this Martian view, this extraordinary caldera, this crater, which is 6 kilometers across and a kilometer or more deep, with these little sort of pearl blue lakes at the bottom and clouds of sulfur wafting around. It's the most incredible sight of my life, and was worth the climb. And you can see it from space. I mean, NASA has photos of it. It's so large. It being the largest eruption of at least the last 10 or 20,000 years on planet Earth, it really made a mark.
I did explain to Neil and to everyone else about VEI, the Volcanic Explosivity Index, my little understanding of that earlier on. So I've been reading up a little bit, and, you know, Vesuvius scoring maybe a 5, Krakatoa a 6. Do you put Mount Tambora as a 7 or as an 8?
Oh, it's listed as an 8. So the explosivity index is exponential. So it's not linear. It's not that 8 is like 15% greater than 6. It's like exponentially larger. When I would tell friends that I was writing about, you know, 19th century volcanism, they'd say, oh, you know, Krakatoa, obviously. Tambora was, let's think of it this way, 6 times larger than Krakatoa.
Right.
We think about, you know, the enormous impact of Krakatoa. Think of a volcano 6 times that the magnitude. And the reason we haven't heard of it, or until now, until my book, of course, changed everything.
Of course.
The reason we haven't heard about it is, well, if you think, what happened between 1815 and 1883?
Yeah.
You know, the invention of the telegraph and the modern communications. And so when Krakatoa erupted, the news was broadcast worldwide, you know, within hours, whereas in 1815 was a world of sailing ships.
When it explodes, what's the physical process of that? What is emitted into the air? How high does it go? What happens?
Oh, yeah. So that's incredibly important. So first of all, the latitude of the volcano is very important. So the fact that it's near the equator, keep that in mind. So, I mean, I suppose our news wires are more concerned with very North Atlantic volcanoes, right? Volcanoes in Iceland and what have you. Now, they are situated at high latitudes, which means that they're, no matter how explosive, say, one of these Iceland volcanoes becomes, it will never have a global impact on climate by virtue of the fact of its high latitude. It can't enter into the global weather system. Whereas near the equator, if you have, you know, it's like a perfect storm. If you have a large volcanic eruption located near the equator, then it's possible for it to have a global impact. And now the other questions that you asked was like, okay, what is it shooting into the atmosphere and how high does it go? Also extremely important. Another question I often get, particularly from Americans, is, oh, so is it like Mount St. Helens, for instance? Mm. You know, well, what was the impact of Mount St. Helens? Now, you gentlemen, you're younger than I am, but so Mount St. Helens was 1980.
We're both alive.
Yeah. Both alive, but barely, I'm guessing. You know, I was a teenager and I remember Mount St. Helens and got a lot of coverage, of course. But its impact on climate was zero because it blew the side out of the mountain.
Mm.
So there are two things. So latitudinal location, but also the stratospheric verticality of the eruption. You need what's called a Plinian eruption. That's the classic one where all the material is ejected directly upwards into the atmosphere. Right. So you have this mix of sort of magma, ash, you know, sulfuric gases all shooting upward. A volcanologist once explained it to me, like an eruption the size of Tambora. Think of the entire topsoil of Illinois and Texas. I'm here in Illinois.
Yeah.
And so Illinois and Texas, I mean, that's most of Europe. So think of the entire topsoil, transferred from beneath the ground into the atmosphere over the course of several hours, maybe a day, 24 hours. So that's an extraordinary transference of planetary matter from from a subterranean zone into an atmospheric and stratospheric zone. So it's when you begin to think about it in terms of that level of volume, and then yes, the pressure has to inject the matter into the atmosphere about into the stratosphere. So that's about 40 kilometers.
So that's how high that would have gone.
Yeah, about 43 kilometers, because otherwise gravity and precipitation, it washes most of it out. And even with an eruption of this size, the greater part of the material just falls back to the Earth.
Okay,
but the crucial thing is that there's a significant fraction that escapes the atmosphere and sits up in the stratosphere like this blanket, right? It just sits up there where it's dry and quiet, and it's above the weather systems of our planet. Sits above the weather systems and then starts to spread itself out across the globe. So within 2 weeks, this volcanic cloud from Tambora has circled the equator. Right, and then you begin to get these incredible sunsets in England and Ireland and elsewhere in the North Atlantic it begins a slow poleward drift. Right,
it sounds to me like the island wouldn't have been massively inhabited, but were there instant deaths and instant mortality? Was that an issue?
Oh, absolutely. So it has the largest death toll in the historical record. It's about 100,000 people. So, Sabah was prosperous and well-populated. So, so you have tens of thousands of people killed from the blast, and all of Southeast Asia is basically in darkness for about a week.
Wow.
I mean, darkness for a week. And it happened right around the rice harvest season, so that rice harvest was destroyed. So you have immediate food crisis, but also one of the volcanic gases is fluorine, and that ends up in the wells and poisons the wells. So people's drinking water is poisoned.
Right.
And so you have the instant destruction of the blast. That's probably, several tens of thousands of people. And then in the days and weeks following, you have the poisoning and the starvation, et cetera. And so the death toll is in excess of 100,000 people, which is the largest of any volcano that we have on record. So a really pitiful, cataclysmic scene.
We're kind of getting a picture now of the scale of the eruption, and also the fact that it is now, as you said, because of its latitude, because of the 43 kilometers up into the stratosphere, we now understand that this is going to have a profound effect on the climate, the global climate. Am I right in thinking the Earth cooled considerably because of Tambora?
Yeah. So what you have is there's a kind of a volcanic wrapping around the planet, filtering out the sun, right? So it reduces the solar input, right? So everything is going to be degrees cooler. Mm.
So what were the weather effects of Tambora, both across Europe and also in Asia, that led to that opium boom in China?
Oh, okay. So these are the flow-on consequences, right? These are the indirect flow-on consequences of a massive weather disruption. The most important primary effect is on agriculture. So, and this is true, in Ireland suffered terribly So the basic weather systems that impact Ireland, you know, the low pressure out in the Atlantic, etc. Those pressure systems shifted, right? That low pressure system that's typically further up near Iceland came degrees of latitude further south, and so generated these large storms that just swept over Ireland through the summertime. I mean, are you used to a lot of summertime storms?
No, not particularly. I mean, no, we're famously, it rains a lot in Ireland, but my reading of this is it rained solidly for the 8 weeks of high summer in Ireland.
Yeah, exactly. The entire summer was wiped out. The biggest impact on agriculture is always going to be on the growing season. With Tambora, eruption in 1815, limited impact in the summer of 1815. But by 1816, 12, 15 months later, you have the full impacts of the eruption are embedded. And Ireland bears the brunt of the storms that start sweeping in, just one after the other.
Yeah.
Other parts of the world, for different reasons, it's drought. According to the change in the storm tracks, the common denominator is cold temperatures,
yeah,
temperatures at which rice can't grow.
Well, let's talk about that, because the failing of the rice harvest, not just once, but 3 years running in China, and particularly the Yunnan province. And so I think what Neil is trying to get to, which is a fascinating story, is that my understanding, again, Gillian, you're the expert, my understanding is that because of the failing 3 years in a row, the peasants in the Yunnan province had to make a decision as to, well, what we can't grow rice. What can we grow to sustain our communities? And they chose opium.
Right. So this is the argument that I make in the book, and I think it's pretty persuasive, that the farmers there, they were leaseholders. They were better off than serfs. And at a certain point after, yes, the second and third rice crops failed, there was starvation, right? It was a famine. The farmers were left with this decision. Grain prices have gone through the roof. Mm. Grain is beyond the reach of the average family. How do you purchase food on the market when the prices are so high? And so the only way is to turn to a cash crop.
Mm.
And the cash crop that was valuable and was a growth market as a commodity crop was opium. So you have this this wholesale transition from rice to opium in Yunnan right at this time, 1817, 1818. And within a decade or two, 90% of the agricultural land is given over to opium production.
One of the wild claims I made in the early part of the podcast to Neil was that the eruption of Mount Tambora gave rise to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And I think that this is one of the more tangible pieces of art that we can actually talk about specifically, because there's a lot of recording of this, the way that the genesis of this book. So can you tell Neil and everyone else how that came to be?
It's certainly not a stretch to connect Tambora to the writing of Frankenstein. So think about Percy Shelley, Mary Shelley. So they've run away together. They're in Switzerland, and they hear that, Lord Byron has taken a villa on the shores of Lake Geneva. And Mary Shelley's half-sister, Claire Claremont, just happens to be pregnant with Lord Byron's child.
How convenient.
So, I mean, how convenient. Yeah, so Claire has really directed their steps towards Switzerland. They weren't necessarily going to be there, but Claire had a hand in directing them there. And so they take a house, of course, you know, next door to Byron's villa. And I teach this, I teach Frankenstein to my students, of course, who are all 18, 19, 20 years old, which is how old they were. I mean, Mary was 18.
Wow.
Shelley only a few years older, Byron in his 20s. So they were young, university aged. And so I imagine that, you know, in their minds, they were going to spend a gorgeous summer in Switzerland with picnicking and boating, taking lots of long romantic walks. Mm. But it was the rainiest and coldest summer in the history of Swiss record keeping. Given that their ordinary sort of summertime enjoyments were cut off from them, they spent their time indoors, and in order to entertain themselves, they said, well, let's have a ghost story competition.
Okay. This is the Netflix of the day.
Exactly. It's like what you do when you're just sitting around the fire. They were taking a lot of opium and and reading from Coleridge's latest volume of poems and working themselves up into sort of semi-hysteria over those. You know, you can imagine the kind of level of erotic intensity. So they went away and Byron wrote a little sketch. Percy didn't get very far and Mary came up with the plot of Frankenstein. So I think clearly the winner, but of the competition. Though it must be said, an honourable mention to Byron's doctor and resident punching bag, John Polidori.
That's right. Tell us about that, yeah.
Yeah, John Polidori, who, as I say punching bag because Byron just, hired him basically so that he could mock him and bully him across Europe. He just needed someone to take out his... his daily frustrations on, and that was John Polidori. And Polidori, as I suppose, is a kind of revenge, you know, sketched out this story about an insane aristocrat who's had a thirst for blood, thinly disguised Lord Byron, and that's the vampire.
Yeah.
Right? So as I say to my students, okay, here's your, at the end of the semester, here's your summer homework, here's your summer project. I want two enduring cultural icons. It can be in sketch story form, that's okay, but I want the equivalent of the vampire and Frankenstein on my desk by the end of the summer.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah, but now, see, if they listen to this podcast, their argument back to you can be, well, we would have written it if there was a massive volcanic eruption, but now that there isn't, we had other stuff to do.
Students are so annoying with their comebacks.
Yeah. And the lack of opium is just shocking. I mean, in fairness.
Oh, yeah. Do we get extra credit if we go and chase the dragon? That's what we really want to know.
Right. Well, see no evil from this professor.
Given the terror that you've described for our listeners in terms of the effects that all of this had on the global climate and particularly, as you said, once it was at a certain latitude and the potential for that to happen, one of the things I was talking to Neil about in part one again was how prepared are we as a civilization for another an eight on the VEI? Because realistically, by the sounds of things, it's not something we can control. I know there was a plan NASA had to cool Yellowstone that was shelved. But if Yellowstone were to erupt at a level like this, I mean, how would we fare as a human race?
I mean, if there were another Yellowstone-sized event, it would be mercifully quick for all of us.
Right.
So we're not really even talking about that. I mean, Tambora is not on. Is not on that scale. That would be like world ending for us.
Right.
What are the differences between now and 200 years ago? You know, we have a population cresting in 9 billion. You had a planet of fewer than 1 billion 200 years ago. The vast majority of the world's population, it's really a pre-industrial world of subsistence agriculture. So particularly in the developed world, we have a great deal more sort of infrastructural insurance against large-scale calamities of this kind. But the other side of the coin is that systemically we're far more exposed,
yeah.
Right? So that if you think about our global supply chain and global agricultural production, that on system-wide, we're extremely vulnerable. That's the bottom line.
Well, I mean, we don't have to even imagine that. I mean, the global pandemic has illustrated the desire in humans to have, sliced bread and toilet paper, and then a ship gets stuck in the canal and all of a sudden there's $50 billion a day of trade not being able to move through. So, yeah, we are systemically, we are hugely open to this.
Yes, yeah. But if you're going to choose somewhere for this to live, if this does happen, you might as well live in a place that produces more food than it consumes, Dave. So,
you want to keep the beef for yourself, Neil?
I want to keep the beef and the spuds and the lovely butter. I can do without your plastics and your oil coming through the Suez Canal if this goes full on apocalypse, which is what is being proposed in your question. All right, yeah. Did the world authorities, if we can call them that, and nation states, did they learn anything from Tambora? Because one thing that we've learned from the pandemic, that the countries that seem to have done the best are the countries that have meaningfully and well-planned health systems and, are strong in terms of their institutions. Did Europe, where we are, did America, did they learn anything from this?
Yeah, well, not quickly enough, but if we think about the immediate post-Napoleonic period, the ideology, the laissez-faire ideology in the ruling classes of Europe, the hold of that ideology was total. Mm. And what I mean by laissez-faire, which is the poor just have to look after themselves. Charity was the work of the churches. I mean, if you think about the modern governmental system was only just beginning to emerge, and this is before any concept of the welfare state. That's when the Tambora disaster happens. My argument, and which I back up with historical documents, is that, for instance, in the aftermath of the disaster that happened in Ireland, you get the first public works program,
right,
initiated by the UK government. It's a public works program. It's like, okay, next time this happens, we'll have a public works program so that we can employ people who would otherwise be on the streets who would otherwise be environmental refugees, because that's what you had across Europe. You had people who were starving on their farms and in their villages just take up, hit the roads and head for the market towns. And then you had conflict and you had the burghers of these towns barring the gates to the multitudes. So you had terrible scenes. It's like, how can we avoid these scenes? We need a public works program. And also you get the first committee dedicated to public health.
Right.
And this is like 1817, 1818, 1819. So a very clear answer to your question, Neil, is that you get the stirrings of a kind of more liberal, progressive model of government. I mean, it wouldn't do to overstate that.
The ideas are being germinated, but I mean, from the basic history that I would have done in school, they weren't necessarily enacted flawlessly, but certainly the idea of it is starting around that time.
Yeah, it germinates. The idea that, oh, actually government has a responsibility to its citizens in time of crisis. That idea really did not exist pre-Tambora.
And didn't it give rise, the fallout of Tambora was that eventually London got a functioning sewage system.
Well, another one of these very indirect flow-on consequences, and we haven't even mentioned the word cholera.
Yeah, cholera, which is
it was one of the sort of, I'd say, the most historically significant outcome of Tambora was its effect on the disease ecology of the Bay of Bengal in 1816, 1817, which gave rise to produced the conditions for what's called a genetic transfer event, whereby you have a new variant of cholera. So cholera has been endemic to the Bay of Bengal from time immemorial. A new variant emerges post-Tambora because of the bizarre ecological conditions. You get a new variant. And that becomes global cholera, which kills tens of millions of people in the 19th century. So it's impossible to imagine. I mean, we've been imagining 19th century without Tambora for generations, but it's never been possible to imagine the 19th century without cholera.
Yeah.
And so by the 1830s, it's reached France and the UK and Ireland, and you have devastating death tolls globally from cholera. And then what Dave is talking about, which is when, the preoccupation of 19th century government becomes public health, sewage systems, the water system, right? Our cities can't survive. Trade can't survive unless we find some way of maintaining basic public hygiene and water quality.
Yeah.
That becomes the focus of, so many government, the human, intellectual, financial resources are thrown at that problem. To create a public health and water infrastructure, that hits in the 1840s and 1830s, 40s and 50s.
Wow.
But it's part of what I call Tambora's long tail.
Yes.
And I think it would be the pandemic is a good analogy. Mm. I mean, there'll be historians at the end of this century who will be looking back to COVID's long tail, right? You have the immediate historical consequences, which we're participating in. But then what will happening in 2040, 2050, 2060, will we be able to tie back to 2020? I think there'll be plenty.
Yeah,
of things.
Absolutely. There
will. The world has been changed by it. Think of COVID as a massive biological perturbation of the world system. Mm. Think of it that way, and think of analogous to Tambora, which was a sort of massive sort of geological perturbation. That affected humanity in a kind of similar way.
You've convinced me.
Listen, Gill and Darcy Wood, I can't thank you enough for joining us, because this was something I only recently learned about. And I'm now, you know, fully convinced of the impact it had on everything in the 19th century, which, of course, again, long tail, we're going super long now, but impacts everything today. I mean, it is a phenomenal geological event that has had a massive impact on everything that we know today.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, it's been fun talking with you guys.
Right, well, I would recommend everybody get their hands on Tambora, The Eruption That Changed the World. That is the book that Gill and Darcy Wood has written. And I had already ordered it before I even spoke to you, Gillan, but I'm very glad I did now. It's arriving in the next couple of days. I can't wait to read it.
Thank you.
Okay, so there we go. Gill and Darcy Wood educated us profoundly on Tambora and the effects it had on everything. Neil, how do you feel now that you've had the expert explain it all to you?
Well, you're definitely irrelevant.
yes.
I think I'm just going to whisper that to you. Do you know about the Roman emperors apparently used to have a slave saying, "Remember, you were only a man." That'll be me with you. Every time I meet you, it'll just be you're irrelevant. He was brilliant. He was really good.
Seriously.
And I hate to say this because you sourced the program. This is the essence of why would you tell me that? Because it's something that hopefully our listeners will find interesting, but also that it should be known and wasn't known. And the fact that you pointed out that Mary Shelley's Frankenstein came from this seismic event would suggest to me that given that the pandemic has given us enough time to create this podcast, we're certainly, I mean, I think we're on a similar track. I think in years to come, people will look back at this collection of nonsense and go, I mean, that was the pinnacle of human achievement.
If we hadn't had the global pandemic, we would never have had the Why Would You Tell Me That podcast, which plainly is the greatest work of art that humanity, forget Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, forget Polidori's Vampire, forget Byron. No, it was Neil and Dave doing Why Would You Tell Me That was when humanity peaked.
In years to come, people will say, you know, if you get enough monkeys and enough typewriters in a room, they will make Why Would You Tell Me That. It won't be they would write out William Shakespeare. I had never heard of this. I thought that was a really well made point. I'd never heard of this. And I feel enriched, I have to say.
Well, then I will consider my work in this episode of Why Would You Tell Me That done. I do recommend that you honestly do further research on Mount Tambora, because we didn't cover everything we wanted to cover in that. There just isn't time in the self-imposed time constraints of this podcast. I don't know why we've self-imposed the time, but we have. But there's so much more to the story. It is utterly fascinating. And even the Irish experience that obviously would mean more to Neil and myself. Like, as he mentioned, this was the forgotten famine. I mean, 100,000 Irish people died in the famine. 800,000 people were displaced, but obviously is overshadowed by the famine of the 1840s. But it has a massive effect, this eruption of Mount Tambora, on every. And I'm sure if you're French and you look into the effect of Mount Tambora on your country in the early 1800s, and same for any nationality, it will be seismic, to use that word again, the effect that this eruption had on wherever you are in the world. So definitely worth pursuing a bit more and reading a bit more about it.
I would suggest, and I don't want to do the book down, but I mean, I would just listen to this and then forget that there's a possible extinction event, a volcano out there, and go about your daily lives. I mean, you could do that either. And that's what I would be doing.
That is an option.
As fascinating as this was, I never want to think about our imminent doom ever again. And that's where we're different.
This podcast is definitely going to bring up imminent doom, I think, on a number of episodes throughout the seasons, however many we do of this.
You're drunk with power. That's what this is. You're drunk with power. I gave you a frog that reproduced in a kind of disgusting but kind of interesting way. And you gave me, if this happens, everything on Earth perishes. But still, buy that merchandise and don't forget to sign up with some Patreon.
Look, you might as well spend your money on us, because God knows it's going to be useless when we all die from a giant volcano. You know what I mean?
Yeah, where we're living in perpetual darkness and I have to sell my kidney to get some rice or some opium.
I know which one I'd pick. Well, I can't wait to hear what you've got for us next week, Mr. Neil Delamere.
Well, I have an expert to talk to us about the Mosuo people of China.
Who?
Well, they live in a matrilineal society.
Don't know what that word is.
Society is where people live together.
Oh, okay, that word, yeah.
Okay. Matrilineal means the power and the inheritance rights are all through the mammy's line and not the daddy's traditional line. And how that affects the people and how that affects everything from their society, their practices, their marriages. They practice something called walking marriages, and even their health is affected by this. So we're going to talk next week to Professor Siobhan Matheson.
Amazing. Cannot wait to investigate that. As always, you can give us a follow on Instagram. We're at Why Would You Tell Me That. Neil is at Neil Delamere Comedy. I am at Dave Today FM. And wherever you listen to this podcast, we would really appreciate it if you would subscribe or follow or whatever that word is. It means you'll never miss a trick. And we'll be doing loads of episodes and you'll be the first ones to know all about them. Neil, before we go, are you doing gigs anywhere? Is there anywhere people can go and see you?
I've put the Edinburgh Fringe Festival tickets on sale. So just doing 12 days. I'm not doing the full thing there. And I'm doing On Green On, one of my favourite counties in the world, in Donegal in July. So have a look at those.
NeilDelamere.com/gigs, the place to go. All right. Thank you as always for listening. This is Why Would You Tell Me That with him, Neil Delamere, and me, Dave Moore. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.